Hello and welcome to the Marble Halls podcast with me, Harvey. And we've got a very special guest joining with us today on episode 2 of the Marble Halls podcast. Before we introduce our special guest, it's our less special. I won't call you unspecial because I know you don't like that. But you're our less special guest, Julian. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well.
Good,
and
good.
I can definitely take less special when it comes to our very, very special guest that we've got today, Keith Edelman.
Thanks for joining us, Keith. Thanks for joining us. I just wanted to start with something very, very basic as a first question. I want to hear your answer to this as well, Julian. So who is your favourite all-time player? I'm not putting a team to it. I'm not putting an era. I just want to know who's your favourite football player?
Probably Thierry Henry.
Okay, good. I think I can live with that one.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Julian, what about you?
My second favourite was Thierry Henry.
Okay, who's your favourite?
Very close.
You can't pick yourself.
Oh, okay, you didn't say that.
Well.
Okay, so taking myself out, Dennis Bergkamp.
Dennis Bergkamp, Thierry Henry, two of Arsenal's greatest players. Agreed. I mean, I wasn't old. Well, I'm too young to have ever seen either of them play.
Really?
Yeah.
Even when Thierry came back?
Well, when he came back, yeah, of course, I've seen that. But to see them through the peak times, the invincible times, the best times. Yeah, no, I wasn't around, unfortunately. But Keith, thank you honestly for joining us today. I've done my research, learned quite a lot about you. Hopefully I've got most of it right as well.
I hope so.
So can you kind of, obviously you were managing director at Arsenal, I believe that was the title. Before you became managing director at Arsenal, before you came to Arsenal, because obviously that's, you know, Arsenal fan channel right here, that's what we want to hear about. What kind of industry did you work in? Who did you work for before you joined Arsenal?
I'd been a CEO for a big retail company, and I'd done a lot of mergers and acquisitions, and I'd done a lot of property as well. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the job that I had to do at Arsenal, it kind of brought all those skills together, which was retail, property, and funding and finance and deals effectively.
Okay, cool. So you joined Arsenal, I believe, in the year 2000.
2000.
So in that time, how were Arsenal doing around the year 2000? Before then, set the scene.
Okay, the scene was, we had great success under George Graham.
Okay.
It had gone downhill a little bit, but nothing like the present times where we'd gone years and years without a trophy. We'd had a few off years. Bruce Rioch had come. It turned out that he was an interim manager. And then we had an Arsene Who turn up. None of us really knew who this guy was. And suddenly, very, very quickly, he changed what Arsenal was known for. Mm. I mean, okay, we started winning, but we also started playing the most traditionally amazingly exciting football. We'd won the double pretty much within his first full season.
Wouldn't that be nice this season?
Yeah, it would be. And then we were very much competing with Man United. We had, I wouldn't say a couple of off seasons, but Man United just about pipped us to the big trophies. I mean, when I look back at 99, it's known for Man United win the treble, but we were a Dennis Bergkamp missed penalty away and 1 point away from doing our own double. So it was kind of an interesting time in that the football was still great, the performances were still exceptional, and the team was exceptional, but we were kind of just second each time.
Just second. Okay, well, things started to pick up a few years later. So you joined Arsenal, as I said, in the year 2000. How did that come about? Because you were saying, you know, you've worked in retail and stuff like that.
Well, I think Arsenal decided that they wanted to move forward and build Emirates Stadium. Mm. And they didn't really have anybody within the business who could do that. So that was my main job, was to come in and really revolutionise the whole, you know, the whole business side, the whole commercial side, and actually start to get the firepower to be able to build the stadium and to develop the stadium project, because that was the most important item on the agenda at that time.
Yeah, was it quite a small team in terms of, like, you know, the commercial side of Arsenal?
Yeah,
before?
It was a pretty small team, and it wasn't a great team at the time. Okay. So we made a lot of changes to that. And the first thing we had to do was get some money, because I remember looking around at the shareholders around the table and no one had any money, or no one was prepared to put any money into the business. So we had absolutely no money whatsoever to actually go out and buy up a lot of properties. We'd identified a site. They'd identified a site, which is obviously where Emirates Stadium is, but we didn't have any money to be able to build it or do anything. So the first thing we had to do was to get some cash. And we did that by selling 10% of the club to Granada. And we sold 10% of the club, and we sold our internet business, which at that time was very, very, very much a shadow of what it is today. Mm. And we did that deal, and we got 77 million in for that transaction, 47 million of it immediately, and 30 million when we started to build the Emirates Stadium.
So was the plan always, before you came in, you were going to come in to help build a stadium?
Yeah. I mean, the directors have been taken to task by the fans, saying, you know, what are you going to do? We can't compete with the Manchester Uniteds. We can't compete. Remembering that money is an very important aspect of football. And if you run your business right and you run the club right, if you've got the right money in the bank, then you should be able to compete at the very top of echelons of the league. And there are two ifs, there are two conditions there. One is you've got to run the business correctly and you've got to run the manager correctly. And secondly, you've got to have the financial firepower to do it. But if you look at football clubs the world over, you'll see that there's a kind of 98% correlation factor between wage bills and success on the pitch. So if you've got a big engine delivering lots of money for the club, then you should be able to invest in the players and develop a squad that actually can win competitions. And that was the objective. So effectively, although the building Emirates Stadium was the number one objective, the real objective obviously was to win trophies and to be very successful on the pitch.
So as Julian said, so around 1999 we're kind of close to winning stuff, and then obviously so what year was it where the decision was, okay, we need to build a stadium?
Probably the end of 99.
Okay, so it kind of matches up about
the end of 99. I think the crescendo was pretty big. And then a site was identified, which is the Ashburton Grove, called the Ashburton Grove site, which is where Emirates Stadium now sits.
Yeah, so as a fan around that time, 1999, 2000, was it time for you as a fan? I know some people have quite fond memories of Highbury and kind of...
Yeah, I think we all do.
Yeah, I think some maybe didn't want to leave or did. I don't know. I think there was quite a...
I talked to you about this bit before. I mean, I think that most of the fans, I think we had a very, very high rate of people who actually wanted a new stadium. Oh, and good. I think they all recognised that Highbury was landlocked. I mean, we couldn't go anyway. We had the road one side. We had blocks of flats behind us, buildings behind us. So there was no way that you could develop Highbury into a world-class stadium. So I think there was a general acceptance by the fans. And we found that when we talked to fans, they were very, very supportive of moving to a new stadium.
Okay. Julian?
I think Keith's right from that time, but the decision to move from Highbury, or the talk from move for Highbury, went back a lot previously, a lot longer
that's right.
than 99. I remember there were discussions about sharing a stadium with Spurs at either King's Cross or potentially Wembley.
Yeah.
And there was huge outrage at that time, and they were kind of using the AC Milan Inter Milan example as one that was successful. Is that when you looked at it rationally, you've got two teams that play alternate weeks, so why wouldn't you put them in the same stadium? Now, for me, I saw the value in that. I saw the commercial aspect of that, and it made perfect sense. For the majority of the fans, from my perspective, I think they're up in arms. I have an early recollection of walking around Highbury. I think it was probably in the 80s or maybe early 90s, of people giving out leaflets in protest at that particular idea. But I think by the time that we got to the time that Keith came on board, I think most fans begrudgingly accepted that we'd outgrown Highbury, because back in those days, the vast majority, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, revenues came from gate receipts more than the broadcast
gate receipts
revenues.
Gate receipts were much more important in those days than broadcast revenues as a percentage of the revenue. So it was a very important element of the revenue.
And I know hindsight's a wonderful thing, but when I look back on it now, I mean, it kind of started after Hillsborough and the Taylor Report, that there used to be standing at Highbury at all grounds. And even though it was relatively small, you could pack in thousands and thousands more than you could. I remember being in a crowd at Highbury of nearly 60,000.
Mm, wow.
And once the Taylor Report came in and you had to have all seating, then those capacities were dramatically reduced.
Okay. Thanks, Julian. So you mentioned as well, so obviously you came in and helped with the whole development of what we know now as Emirates Stadium. How does that process work? Like, it takes a number of years, I'm sure. But...
yeah, I mean, I think we did it in really quick time. I mean, I think that was the incredible thing about the development, because we actually moved in 2006. So it took 6 years from beginning to end. So I identified the site. We had to buy a lot of properties from a lot of property owners. So we employed a guy called Anthony Spence, who did a magnificent job, who actually negotiated a lot of those property acquisitions. And in the middle of the Emirates Stadium, there was something called a waste transfer station. So right in the middle of the pitch, there was a waste transfer station, which is basically where the six boroughs around Highbury all come with their dust carts and dump all the rubbish on the ground, effectively. And then there's a bulldozer that takes it off and puts it into landfill somewhere. I always used to say Essex, but I apologise for that to Julian. So they used to take it off and dump it as land waste. And so that was all council owned. And the council owned quite a bit of land as well, other bits of land there. So we had to do a deal with the council, and then we had to get planning. And we got planning also for Highbury Stadium alongside the Emirates Stadium. And that was quite a lengthy process and quite a fraught process at times, because it meant we had to do road closures, which a lot of people objected to because of where Emirates Stadium was. So we had to assemble the land. And in order to move the waste transfer station, we had to buy another plot of land the other side of Holloway Road. And that was a fraught negotiation with Sainsbury's. Sainsbury's had a very big plot of land, about 18 acres of ground, which they had for a supermarket, but had been refused planning permission. And I happened to know the property director at Sainsbury's because he worked for me previously. And so we contacted him and we entered into negotiations with him. There was a Spurs consortium who were trying to outbid us to put our little development underway, and we managed, through relationships and putting a bit more money on the table, to eventually buy that piece of land. Because that's where we moved the waste transfer station to. And the development was really complex, because there were three really difficult bits of the development. The first one was moving the waste transfer station.
So where is that now?
Other side of Holloway Road.
So did Arsenal still own that, or they had to sell that?
No. That was given to the waste authorities. So the waste authority is a separate organisation from the council. So we had to build that waste transfer station, and we had to fully fit it out. We estimated, when we did our first numbers, that the existing waste transfer station, just to give them what they had, would be about £12 million. And the final bill for the one that they wanted was 68 million. So it was a big, big gap. And the deal was that we couldn't effectively finalise everything and get the freehold of the site from the council until the waste transfer station was up and running. So there was an incredible amount of detailed work, because we had to agree every specification with them for the waste transfer station, because the way the deal worked was that once we finished it, they had to move, but we had to build it to the spec, absolute spec, that they designed. So in the old one, as I said, they used to just dump the rubbish on the floor. In the new waste transfer station, they've got compactors, about 12 of them, costing like $250,000 each.
Oh, wow. Okay.
To compact the rubbish up into smaller amounts so that it can take more on lorries. So it was a really complex piece of building and construction.
And Arsenal had to pay for all these upgrades.
Yeah, yeah, we paid the 68 million, so that was a big part of our cost.
And that was to the council in effect?
No, it was to the Waste Transfer Authority, which operates for the eight councils. So it's a North London Waste Authority.
So not only did they get it moved for nothing, but they got a better...
They got a 21st century waste transfer station from a shed, which they had before. And it also contained all the vehicles, the council vehicles. They had 120 vehicles. So in that facility, we also had to put 120 vehicle parking facility in. And the old facility was open to the air. This one, obviously, because it was near residential accommodation, which was planned, had to be completely sealed, hermetically sealed, so no smells came out. I mean, the old transfer station, was a real eyesore.
I never knew about any of this.
No, it was a real eyesore. And I mean, I'll never forget the day before when we just took it over, someone dumped a dust van in there, a dust truck with all the rubbish in it. And you always used to go around there and see. In the summer, it was really, I mean, to go within 200 yards of it was not a nice smell.
Sounds dreadful.
It was a horrible place. Whereas the new one is perfectly, there's no smells and it recycles all the waste. And we had to put in 120 parking spaces, but also workshops. So they were really expensive. One of the workshops cost £1 million because it had to have air handling equipment, and all the latest equipment was put in. I mean, what they had before was quite small compared.
So Arsenal, in effect, spent £68 million on a very expensive piece of rubbish.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is obviously cheaper than Pepe.
Less than Pepe, though.
Yeah, less than Pepe.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting. I didn't know that. Yeah. So basically, part of the project of building the Emirates was building the stadium, redeveloping Highbury to what it is today.
Highbury
and then
Square.
Also this...
Yeah, this. So we had three really big building projects.
Wow.
And then the other pieces of land that we owned, we sold off to developers. So we sold off all the other land on Queenston Road and we sold all the other bits of land off. And that brought in revenue to help us build the stadium, effectively. Because the big issue we had was whether we could raise enough money to effectively get enough cash together to build the stadium, because in order to build a stadium we had to borrow a lot of money. We had to borrow 260 million. We borrowed that through project finance. It was the first project finance deal that had ever been done in the UK, where we didn't own the freehold when they signed the deal, because we couldn't own the freehold because the freehold didn't transfer till the waste transfer station was finished. So we started building the stadium.
You didn't own the land at that point?
No, we didn't own the land at that point.
But so as soon as the waste transfer was completed, that triggered the ownership. And does Arsenal still own the land that Highbury's on, or was that completely sold?
No, it owns the land. The freehold was actually sold off, but it did own it. When we developed Highbury, we did own the land.
Okay.
But we sold the freehold off afterwards. So the tenant's lease, but we sold the freehold off for another revenue source.
Okay, so now Arsenal have no ownership
rights at all in the old Highbury. No.
Okay. Well, so how much did the stadium cost? And if someone was to rebuild the Emirates today, would it cost a lot more?
Yeah, it would. We built it for 260 million. We had Sir Robert McAlpine as the contractors. And we signed a contract with them to build, finish the design off and build the stadium. I mean, when I say finish it off, we had designed exactly what we wanted, but they had to take over the responsibility for that and build the stadium. And we worked with them hand in glove. We had a very good project team on that that task. And they built the stadium, and we actually built the north side first.
Okay.
So we built the north side around the waste transfer station. So the waste transfer station was still operating and we were building around the north side. It was touch and go whether we get all this done. And I talked about the other two technological or engineering feats. The other two obviously were the two bridges that we had to bring in, the north bridge and the south bridge. And the north bridge was a smaller bridge and that came in and was lifted into place. And there was the biggest crane in Europe came to lift it. and it came with 12 other cranes, which built the big crane. So the big crane built it, you know, was built on the site.
It wasn't very simple then, was it?
No, and lifted it into position. And then we had to dismantle the whole thing and take the crane all the way around the other side to lift in the second bit of the bridge. Wow. And the southern bridge was too heavy to actually lift. So it was actually pushed over over the railway line. So that was how we did it. So they were the big engineering feats that were accomplished.
Did they have to shut the railway line at all during
That's the really complicated bit. You have to get what's called possessions over the railway line, so the railway line's shut when it's done. And that's why it's also time critical, because they give you a weekend where they shut it and you move one bridge in, and then, you know, you move the other side in a couple of weeks later. If anything goes wrong, you lose the possession, and then you've got to go back to Network Rail and get another possession, and that might be months away. So they were really high risk elements of finishing the stadium off. So it was very complicated.
Were there any big challenges that you face?
I think the biggest challenge was money. I mean, we borrowed about 150 million from Barclays to build the stadium. And we were going through that pretty quickly because we bought up all the properties. We started the construction, and we were really tight for cash. I can remember once that we had to get a property deal away on a Monday in order to be able to draw down the next bit of cash from the bank. Otherwise, we couldn't pay the wages for the players on the Thursday. So we were quite tight for cash. Well, yeah. And we owed our lawyers something like 5 million. We owed money all over the place. And the most difficult element was raising the cash, because football stadiums had at that time a very bad reputation for going very badly wrong. Big construction projects had a very bad reputation for going very wrong. And we had to raise 260 million. And you've got to remember, at that time, our turnover was about 60 or 70 million. Mm. So we had a big ask of the banks to borrow 260 million. So the first time we tried to do it, we actually failed to raise the cash in 2003. We worked with about 8 banks, and we sat in a room one day when they all went to credit committee, and the first bank came in positive, which gave us 75 million. And then another bank came in positive, and then we started getting a lot of no's and negatives. So we actually had to stop kind of everything, because we couldn't raise the cash to be able to, you know, carry on. And we then went back to the market with a new deal. So we then went back with the thought process that we could sell our kit rights forward for 10 years. So we did a deal. We had to do a deal with Nike to do that. In fact, Nike came in with 100 million up front to do that deal. And they had a matching right on the deal. And we went to Adidas. And Adidas came back with something like 140 million.
Okay.
So we took it back to Nike, and Nike said they'd match it. So we got 140 million from that deal. And then we did the Emirates deal, and we got cash up front for that.
So was the Nike deal, that money, like the 10-year deal, that money was put towards building the stadium?
Yeah, that money was put towards building the stadium. And then we did the Emirates deal, which also brought more cash in. And then we worked out that we were going to start to sell some of the seats forward. So we sold, there were a whole block of club seats, very good, the best seats in the house, which we sold forward. So we asked people to pay for 3 years in advance.
Wow.
And so we accumulated enough money so that in 2004, we got the loan in place, the 260 million loan. And we could start to build the stadium.
If we go back to one of those deals, I mean, being in business myself, I understand that if you need cash up front, you have to do certain deals at a discount to get the money in. So the Nike deal, you said, was worth how much in the end?
140.
Okay, and you got the majority of that up front?
Yeah, yeah.
So if you'd done that over the 10 years... How much do you think that would
have
been worth?
More, because you've got to discount the money because you get it up front. So you probably got 160 or something.
Yeah, so it wouldn't have been that much more.
It wouldn't have been that much more. I mean, I think Adidas really wanted Arsenal. At that time, we just won the double, and yeah, you know, we were the bees. We do, you know, invincible years, etc. So they really, really wanted us. So they put the price up for Nike. So yeah, we ran that auction. That took months to run the auction. Yeah, which was exciting.
I mean, with my businesses, I don't have the brand that Arsenal has. So I'm very proactive in going out to get my clients, cold calling, networking, getting to them. I'm the one that's having to lead the negotiations. I want to do the business with them rather than vice versa. When you're in that position and you have a brand like Arsenal behind you, is it the complete opposite that these companies are clamouring to do business with you?
I think you're still taught. You've still got to engage with them and talk to them. And like Addy, we spent a lot of time talking to them before we went to the market. So, you know, I think relationships are quite important, and I think you've got to get on with people, and you've got to be able to work with them and get a contract. But on that deal, I mean, it's really complicated, because when you get a matching right, we had to actually do the deal with Adidas. So we did the deal with Adidas, and that's probably a 250-page deal. You know, it's a very, very long contract. And it just had one precondition that Nike didn't match the deal, and then Nike matched the deal, and we had to write another contract with Nike. And of course, you know, they were supposed to sign the same deal, but they didn't, and they said, "Well, we can't accept all these terms." So we had another negotiation for that.
Did Adidas know then that Nike were trying to get it as well?
Yeah. Adidas. No, we were very honest with Adidas. Okay. We said, "Look, Nike have got a matching right, so you've got to be aware of that before you go into this." I mean, they were very upset they didn't get it, but that's business. Yeah. So
we did it now.
Yeah, you know, and the documentation. I mean, to do the banking deal was immensely complicated. And we had a room which was probably 80 foot long by 50 foot, and there were documents around every bit of that room. And it took me 4 hours to sign the final financing, because everything had to fit. Every piece of land had to be in place. Every contract had to be in place, had to be checked by the banks. And there were six banks involved. So it was a really complicated transaction.
Yeah. So one of the things I've heard was that back in the day where you were in that position, the commercial team was about six people, and now it's about 70 people.
Yeah, so, I mean, we ran it very lean and mean. I mean, you know, so we had very small teams of very highly motivated people. And one of the things that I say that I learned from this period is that if you have A-star performers, you know, you can get a lot done. And if you actually cut out all the bureaucracy and just get everyone focused on the task at hand, we got a huge amount done. And during this period, of course, we had all the normal stuff. I mean, we had to change the Arsenal badge.
Yeah, I want to talk about that.
Well, we had to do that. I mean, my predecessor, David Dean, had started a legal case against somebody selling Arsenal shirts in the street.
And I think that was Matthew Reed.
Yeah, Matthew Reed. So it was a pretty famous case. Matthew and David was kind of suing him because he sold an Arsenal shirt in Avenel Road. And it came to pass that when we actually looked into it, we actually didn't really own the trademark to the Arsenal shield. So we decided to change. We had to change the mark. I mean, we couldn't carry on with the lawsuit because we couldn't prove that we had copyright. So we actually, that's when we redesigned the Arsenal badge. Fortunately, there was a guy called Michael Carr on the board at the time, who was a really sensible guy. And he and I worked on it. I mean, I did 90% of the work. He was the kind of non-exec that worked with me. And we ended up with what you've got today. And I've actually at home got the original drawings of all the ramifications.
So what could have been, I've got them all on
my wall.
Is this your favourite one then, I assume?
Yeah. That was the one we settled on. And you know, there were huge arguments on the board. Everyone said, oh, I don't like it. I think it's awful. I said, you'll love it. And in the end, everyone said, oh, it's wonderful. It's much better than the old badge.
What did you think?
Fantastic.
What was the kind of consensus amongst fans?
Okay, I'm really glad you said what you said, because back in those days, I mean, I had a meeting with Matthew Reed back at that time. So I knew the background to the case. I don't remember the club coming out at the time when you changed the crest for the reasons you were doing it, although I knew the reasons you were doing it.
We never said to anyone, well, actually, anyone. I mean, the problem was we couldn't sell any shirts then because we didn't have the rights to sell them.
No, you didn't own it.
Anyone could have sold shirts.
Yeah, so I always knew the reason.
Yeah.
I think now it's probably more out in the public sphere. It's definitely out now, the reasons. But the club put absolutely different spin on it, which to me, okay, I was in the know.
Yeah,
was absolute rubbish that it was changing it for all the benefits of the fans. As a traditionalist, I like the old logo. But one thing I've come to embrace is that there needs to be change.
Yeah.
And that, okay, there was a very practical reason why it had to be done. And if I had, you know, if it was up to me, I'd still have the band marching around at halftime.
Yeah.
I'd have a different playlist. But then I understand now that at 50 years old, what I like isn't particularly what every fan likes, and the taste of the fans change. So I get it. Mm. I totally understand why it had to be done. Although for me, dropping Victoria Concordia Crescent from the logo was sacrilege.
But nobody understood the Latin anyway.
Well, I
did. Not many people understand the Latin. So I think it was a move for good. I think, you know, these things have got to be moved on. And I think it's a very modern, you know, insignia. And I think it works really well.
Yeah, it does work. I understand the reasons for it. Victoria, Concordia Crescent,
you know,
out of victory, there's harmony. I think that's fundamental to our club's motto.
The problem is that you do certain things. Like for the last season at Highbury, We did the that's very special shirt.
It was.
And we took it to the fans because Nike were very worried about it. And I said, no, we're going to do it. Actually, it was the idea of my communications director.
Okay.
It was her idea to do something like that. And we did a bit of research. I mean, we weren't really sure what shirt they first wore when they went to Highbury in 1936, but we thought that was kind of like something like the colour. And we took it to the fans, and we said to the fans, you know, we did a focus groups, and we asked the fans what they thought about you know, the existing shirt, etc. And then we brought this shirt out and said, well, what would you think about that? What happens if Arsenal decide to play the last season in that shirt? They said, we would hate it and we'd never buy one and we'd never touch it. It was disgusting. And then we said, well, what happens if we told you it was the first shirt that they ever wore? We don't care. We wouldn't care. We'd still think it was disgusting. We'd never buy it. That was the best-selling shirt that Arsenal ever produced. So, you know, what people feel in their heart doesn't actually work sometimes with the way they act and they react and their wallet works. So
I wasn't part of the focus group, but I can say it was my favourite ever shirt.
Yeah, and I think it's still
my favourite. And it's actually the last Arsenal shirt from the official shirts that I ever bought.
Yeah.
And I still wear with pride. I've got Bergkamp on the back.
Shirt.
It's my favourite shirt.
Yeah.
Other than that green one back in 84.
I don't even remember
which was so horrible that it became iconic.
Yeah, I think I've seen that recently, actually.
Yeah.
That's kind of come back a little bit. Something else I wanted to ask you about. I know we've kind of moved on a little bit from the stadium stuff, but obviously the Emirates, you said about 240 million. That
260.
260 million that cost. So Tottenham's stadium, which, you know, you spoke about rubbish waste management in a stadium, their toilet bowl of a stadium cost them just over 1 billion.
Yeah.
Is that more, as you know,
I think if you built Emirates today, it would cost a lot more.
A billion?
I think it would cost like 600 or 700 million, 750 million. I think that's where it would be today.
I think the real comparison needs to be about how much they spent on Wembley at the time, because they were roughly the same kind of time.
And Wembley was about 750, but Wembley had a lot of problems. I mean, I think that one of the things that we did was we worked every day on site with the builders. So, you know, if we had a problem, and we did have problems, then we would solve them on the spot. So, I mean, like one of the problems we had, which was a late on problem, which was a nightmare, was the architect had mucked up the press box. So my communications director said we've got to have the best press box in the Premier League. So we had this great press box where they had huge amounts of room, and they could sit there with their lovely desks and all their internet and everything, and they were on a step and a half in the stadium. And I went around with my operations director, who's still there, John Beattie, and we just looked at this and we thought, something's wrong here. And then we started to realise that, that what they'd done by putting these seats in, we had 2,500 seats with restricted views both sides. We had 5,000 restricted view seats because the press would impinge on their site views. So we had to change that. I mean, you know, some of the specs we had we really worked hard on the fans' experience. So we recognise that the fans, and I'm not talking about the hospitality, I'm talking about the average fan. We really focused on the average fan, and we basically said, you know, they want to get in quickly. So we were one of the very, very early stadiums with electronic entry completely around the stadium. They want to sit on a very comfortable seat, and we upgraded the seat, and that cost $2 million to upgrade the seats from the original spec, which was a basic seat. And I think the seats at Emirates are still the best seats you'll get any stadium.
I would concur with that.
And the guy who came in, you know, was they were an Australian company, I think, and they were, you know, they kind of gave this presentation saying they tested thousands of bottoms on seats, and this was the one. And you thought, well, is this a lot of drivel? But when we saw the seats, and we actually didn't, when we ordered it, they hadn't got one actually. They got a prototype, they hadn't got a manufactured one, and we were the first people to put them in. So we've got great seats. Then the toilets, we were very keen to have fantastic, it sounds funny, but I think it's all part of the fan experience. So we've got great toilets. And if you go into the toilets after the match, they don't smell after the match. They're very clean, and they're special chemical toilets, very expensive. And then the fourth thing is they all want to drink. A lot of people like to drink beer, so we put in £1 million cooling system so that they could pull 12 pints in 30 seconds. So that was that level. So we looked at each customer group and gave them what we thought were the very best facilities in the country at that time. So, you know, if you got to club level, we had very, you know, very nice facilities. And, you know, I think we did some things that were, you know, very innovative at the time. And I said, if you're going to spend that much on a ticket, you don't want to have to not get a drink at half time. So we gave free drinks at half time. Now, we put that price back into the season ticket.
Yeah, which I would say is included.
But even so, you know, people still think that's probably one of the best things at Emirates Stadium. If you're fortunate enough to go to club level, that you get that. And then box level was also, you know, a very big revenue earner for us. Remembering we had like 800 premium seats at Highbury, we went to 10,000 premium seats at Emirates. So that's where the real revenue generation came from. Of course, you know, right up to the Diamond Club, if you're lucky enough to have gone in there, where we replicated the Marble Halls.
Marble Halls podcast.
Yeah, and we replicated the Marble Halls. It's got the cannon in the granite floor. And it's all polished concrete, and we chose the marble for the bar in Italy. So it's an amazing, amazing experience. We had special designers to do that.
We talk about the stadium and obviously all these facilities, and it was of great. I mean, what is it now, about 15 years old almost, the stadium?
Yeah,
almost.
Yeah.
So obviously it was very good at the time, and I think it still is a great stadium. I can't say I've been to many stadiums, but I just know I'm impressed whenever I go to the Emirates. But when you look now on the outside of the stadium and some of the seats, you know, some of the crest is almost like faded, almost like a pinky colour now. Would you think it's time for them to kind of like take it down and, like, you know, put a refreshed
all buildings, you've got to keep them up to spec. Yeah. And, you know, I think they're probably a bit shy on the maintenance of some of the aspects there, but you know, I think it's still a great stadium.
It's a great stadium.
It presents well. But at the same time as doing that, you know, we were still working on the club. I worked pretty close with David Dean and Arsene on squad development, which is an important aspect, I think, of what a managing director should do. And I think too few directors actually get involved in that. And we strategically built the squads.
So who did you sign? Who are you involved with?
Some of the players, not a lot, because David used to do that. But in terms of what we needed, and in terms of the squad format and formation, David, Arsene and myself used to discuss that around about January, February every time. And we used to actually execute on that.
Yeah, so what was your involvement in that? Because from what we understand as fans, Arsene Wenger would identify who he wanted, and David Dean would go out and do the deal. What was your involvement with these, transfers? Not only bringing players in, but sort of shipping players out.
David's a great deal maker. So I think, and that's one of the things that when David went, I think that held the club back for many years because nobody could do the deals that David did. So David was very, very good deal maker. But actually the thinking about what we needed in the squad, I mean, I'm not a football guru, but I listened to how Arsene wanted to build his team and put that into a strategic framework and made David and Arsene work to that strategic framework. So Arsene said, I think I want this player, but I said, hold on, Arsene, you know, you said that this is how you're going to build the squad and we've got gaps here and that's more important than what you might want. And so I think that what you've seen over Arsene over the years is that they've had, you know, they've bought five midfield players, you know, and not had a centre back. And it's all that kind of logic flow that you've got to go through. And also, Arsene was he was a great manager and he was very good at spotting talent. But he wasn't very good on valuations. I mean, I remember one player he wanted and he said, well, you know, I said to him, how much do you want to bid? He said, 8 million. I said, but they bid 10 for him. Someone else bid 10 last season, didn't get him. So you're going to have to bid more than 10. So he said, well, it's not worth more than 8. And I said, but do you want him, Arsene? And he said, yes. I said, David, bid 12 then and go and get him. And we got him. And that was Wiltord. And Wiltord scored the winning goal for the Invincibles at Old Trafford. And, you know, that is worth the extra 2 million. So I think it was a team effort. I was very important in the strategic bit, but not so important on the execution bit.
Yeah, it was actually for the double. It wasn't the Invincibles.
Sorry to pull you up on that.
That's one of my little things.
So, talking of the Invincibles, though, that's obviously an incredible feat that no team has been able to achieve. Yeah. And I don't know if a team...
I think the amazing thing about the Invincibles is that when we were going through the season, it kind of didn't dawn on us till about the last 10 games that, you know, we'd gone unbeaten. You know, so, oh, my God, we've gone unbeaten. And then the stress levels really got high because you didn't want to get beaten. And you wanted to end up being invincible, and we did it.
So that achievement, quite a good commercial draw as well for brands to kind of join.
I think we were the, I mean, you know, the ratios always were, and it's easier to do these fan surveys overseas because, you know, overseas is where you pick up more new fans and people come to the Premier League. So the ratio always was that, you know, Manchester United was 8, you know, Liverpool was 4 and we were 2. And we were going up towards close to 4. So we were getting, you know, to 50% or 60% of where Manchester United were. So we were really growing our brand worldwide. And we had lots of efforts to grow our brand worldwide. We did joint ventures in Thailand and Vietnam and a lot of other parts of Asia.
And were there any deals that were presented to you because of the opportunities that were coming up that you rejected?
Oh, yeah, there are lots of deals we rejected.
Was there any kind of weird and wonderful ones that just got kicked into touch and you didn't share with us?
Yeah, I mean, and we were always looking to develop players as well in some of these jurisdictions. So we had a very good development person who worked out in the Far East and set up training camps in the Far East, having worked in Africa and brought the Ivory Coast team and you know, there were like, I think he brought 11 players through from you know, 12 or 14 right up, and 6 or 8 of those, including the Kolo brothers, were both Premier League players. So an amazingly talented man.
What was the academy set up like then? You know,
well, the academy was good. I mean, we had lots of good young players, and there was a big move because especially during these years when we were winning things and we were playing really well, Arsene would never put the young players on the pitch. And so, you know, I was asked to go and have a chat with Arsene to see if we could get him to play a few more young players because everyone was getting upset, the young players. And I went to see Arsene, I'll never forget the conversation. I said, Arsene, you know, couldn't you just put a young player on for 10 minutes? And he turned around to me and says, young players make mistakes. If they make a mistake and we get a goal, we might be 2-0 up when I put him on. We'll go 2-1 and then we're under pressure. So I'm not prepared to do it. I said, completely understand, Arsene, and walked out and told the board that we weren't putting young players
on. And who asked you to have that conversation?
Oh, that was the board that kind of said, you know, if we've had this conversation. And Liam Brady, who ran the youth team. So we had the conversation. I completely agree with him. We never did that.
Okay, but the board attempted to put him under pressure.
Not
to
really.
Change
no,
the team.
Just, have
just
a discussion.
A suggestion.
It was a suggestion, more of a suggestion. He didn't tell Arsene what to
do. And was he upset by that? Or
No. Arsene was a really great guy. He was always prepared to have discussions and debates. And we had lots of discussions and debates about, well, why don't you play this player here? Well, I can't because of this, this and this. So he was very analytical about it. But I think his demise was very, I thought, was quite sad, because effectively what happened after David left and I left is that no one worked with him, so he had to do everything himself. And he was what I call a brilliant micromanager of running a team. He wasn't a very strategic guy. And he was so immersed in the detail of running the team that he couldn't get up to do transfers and all that stuff and do his job and run the team during the season. So that's why I think it fell apart.
So looking at the structure of the club now, so obviously the Kroenkes are full ownership, yeah. And then there's, you know, Edu, technical director, helping with like transfers and stuff, and Mikel Arteta, somewhat of a take in that, it seems. And then there's Vinay as well, I think, kind of like CEO. Yeah. Does that structure work for the club now?
I mean, most clubs have gone for technical directors now. And I think if you get the right technical director, it can be a good format. I'm probably a bit old fashioned and like to see a manager who wants to bring a squad in. It depends how those work as a team. And so it depends again whether they're working as a team, and who in the responsibility of making them work as a team goes in different places. I mean, I worked with some of the best CEOs in my time, probably Martin Edwards at Manchester United was the best. And I never forget him when he left, said to me, oh, Manchester United won't have a few good years now. And that's when we were resurgent. Because he said, you know, they've just bought another midfield player when they should have bought someone in the centre back. You know, I don't understand it. And that was because the manager wanted it. So this is all a part about how you manage the club. And that's why I think management is underestimated in football. But the way you manage that, those players doing that is quite important. And we had a coach, we had a scout who was, I would say, not very good. And I mean, he ended up as a director of football. I won't name him at a club. And, you know, you thought to yourself, you know, he went from 50,000 to $250,000 as a director of football. You thought, this is nuts, because this guy's not very good. And he worked for us. And so, you know, I think there are some examples of that go along, where people, you know, ex-footballers, you know, who come along and people say, oh, he can be director of football, pay him a lot of money. And of course, there's a lot of money swirling around in clubs. And I think some of them aren't as good as they should be. But that's the job, I think, of the CEO, to oversee that and be responsible for it. And I think that one of the issues at Arsenal after we left is the CEO seemed to abdicate all that and say, well, that all happens down at London Coney. I sit up here in an ivory tower. And I think that that's not the way to run a good football club.
Yeah. I appreciate that you won't name the individual, but would you name the club?
No.
Okay. isn't he?
Yeah, should we just say it's Tottenham?
You can say what you want.
Say what you want. Okay. So... also, I just want to kind of ask you, so the Kroenkes are full like owners of the club.
Yeah.
Is that, the in your opinion, the best way for it to be? Because I know that, I think at the time they had maybe like a 12% stake or something in the club, or 60 or something.
I mean, I was I we had a deal with Kroenkes MSL club, and actually when I went over to the States, because they opened their new stadium, that was when the Kroenke deal first came to fruition. And no one knew about it until then. And it was the Granada stake that we sold to them, the 10% that went to Kroenke. And it all got very, very difficult at that time, because there was a lot of politics going on the board of Arsenal, which were not particularly great news. And, you know, it made it a quite difficult situation. I've met Stan a number of times. I think he owns it as a financial owner, not as a lover of the club. And I think that's a shame. It's my personal view. I think it's great when people, I mean, if you look at Abramovich, he really loves Chelsea. And I think you're much better to have an owner who loves the club and hurts if they lose and if they're not doing well, rather than someone who's a financial owner of a club who owns it as an asset.
There's been talk recently of Daniel Ek, who founder, CEO of Spotify, and bringing some of the legends in, like I think Henri and Bergkamp and Vieira, you know, these kind of people in. Was that just a PR stunt, do you think, or do you reckon there's something in that?
I mean, I don't know because I'm not in the flow of that, but I would think Stan's quite a long-term holder of this asset because he believes, and I spoke to him, you know, he owns NFL clubs in the States.
Yeah.
And
they've
and
opened, of course, an incredible new stadium.
And
as well,
of course, the great thing about football, which is not the same for NFL, is it's a global market. So I think they see that the value of these clubs is going to continue to rise throughout the next 10, 15 years. So as an asset, he holds it. His son was always interested in football. He played football. Stan's not really interested in football.
Was he any good? Are we going to see him up front anytime soon?
No. So I think that, you know, I think you've got someone who's a financial owner of the club who owns it as a financial asset.
Okay. And also, so if you were, you know, still in your role now at the club, where would you, you know, what direction would you try and take it? As I say, the structure's kind of changed since you were there, but, you know, is there anything particular you think, oh, you know, Arsenal just signed this player, or, you know, Arteta needs more control, less control?
I think the two most important things are that you've got to set a strategy for how you're going to recover.
Okay.
Because, you know, I mean, you said to me, I think earlier, Julian, that we're doing quite well. I mean, and I said,
I disagree.
10th
well.
Is just ridiculous.
Exactly.
For a club of Arsenal's size. And, you know, I'll never forget Martin Edwards from Manchester United. And this is a different kind of view. But when we'd kind of come second to Manchester United, remember we came second quite a few seasons. He said to me, you know, if Arsenal doesn't win, you should fire him and get someone who can win the league for you. And that, you know, and I, that kind of took me back a bit because Arsenal was revered then. And I suddenly thought, you know, that's absolutely right. You've got to have a group of people who can actually win the league, and you've got to believe that they can win the league.
That's the aim at the end of the day, isn't it?
It should be the aim to win the league and to win European competitions. So I think that in my view, the most important thing is for someone to run the club and actually take responsibility to make that happen. And it shouldn't be, you know, who is responsible here? And I think that greyness causes a problem. And I think that for Arsenal, it should be focusing on deciding what your strategy is. So, you know, can you do it in 2 years, 3 years or 5 years? You know, but what is that timescale and what is the journey you're going to go on? And what are the things you're going to put in place and where are you going to make those investments?
Okay.
So I think that's a really important part of clubs, and I think people underestimate that.
Yeah. Well, we're coming towards the end now. I've got a couple more things I'd just like to ask. I read that in 2007 you became president of the Arsenal ladies team, which is now the women's team. And then in 2008 you resigned from your role at the club, and then 2009 continued in a consultancy role.
Yeah,
talk me through that, the ladies team.
Yeah, you know. Well, I mean, I think when David Dean left, he was president of the ladies team, so someone had to do it, so I was given the job. And so, you know, we sorted a lot out. There was a lot of problems with the ladies team at that time. And we did believe in ladies football, and I still believe in it, and I think it's an important part. And I mean, we tried to make sure that at Emirates Stadium, you know, it was a welcoming place to women. I think it's an important part that this ends up as a family sport, not just as, you know, blokes going on a Saturday. So I think it's an important part of football's development. And I think that you know, we've seen the women's game flourish, and I'm pleased about that. I mean, I decided I'd done, you know, over 8 years, I'd worked really hard. I did 50 matches a year, and I wanted to have a third career. So I left to start my third career. I was on a consultancy agreement with the club for a year to help them out, which I did till end of 2009. And I've gone on to develop a kind of portfolio career where I'm non-exec director. I'm chairman of three companies now, and that's what I enjoy. And it's a bit more relaxing. And I was, you know, being a CEO in the way that I did it is quite, and that's the way I would do the job. Is very hands-on. You know, we knew all the fans. We used to walk around the stadium and talk to people.
Club don't do enough of that.
I knew all the stewards, and if you're doing it like that, it's quite a full on job. We did 50 matches a year, went to every home match, every away match, every European match. I don't think I ever missed a match in all those years. I think I missed one when I had a puncture and I couldn't get to it. But I mean, apart from that, we made every match, and it's quite a personal burden if you're going to do that and the job that way. And you asked me, I didn't answer the other question, what would I do? The other thing I do at the club is I cut out a lot of staff. There's far too much overhead in the business now, in my view.
Okay.
And, you know, it got very, very bloated, over the last 5 to 6 years. And we ran with a real skeleton group of people who loved Arsenal, wanted to make it work, and felt an affinity to the fans. And I always used to say, and this was a bit of a debate, we used to have an argument about it, but I always used to say, I think I want to treat the fans as customers, because by doing that, we don't take advantage of them because they have to come here. And I think that's a very important principle to have in it. But don't ever forget that we're a club, not a business. And that was a very, very important principle to me. So that's why on a match day, I would walk, you know, all my hospitality areas. I knew some of the fans. I'd walk areas. We'd know people. I knew all the stewards. And I would try and make sure that we weren't, you know, some amorphous big business, that we were a club and we carried on with the club traditions. Because I think that's really important. And I fear that a bit of that's lost in football today. I think a lot of the CEOs are overpaid, you know, and they don't have that same view that they want to be with the fans and they want to treat this as a club, although it is a business and you've got to accept that. But the business is to take as much money as you can in order to make yourself successful and make sure you keep your fans happy.
Cool. Yeah, no, that's interesting. I mean, that's something which we were speaking about, Julian, of tradition with vision. Not sure if that means anything to you.
Yeah, it does.
A bit about that.
Well, I think that was our tagline for the new logo, and I think it was, you know, we said, look, we want to be a traditional club, but we want to be visionary. So we want to hold all the important parts of our history and be honourable to them, but at the same time be visionary and do exciting things. And I think that's been lost a bit. I think Arsenal's that visionary now, and I think they've lost a bit of their tradition. I think they take the fans for granted, and I don't think they spend enough time with the fans. I mean, we started fan forums, and we used to have, you know, very lengthy fan forums. And I supported and started the Arsenal Supporters Trust and funded it, because I think that's an important part of it as well.
Okay. Any closing remarks, Julian, on what we've learned today?
Yeah, I think I'd definitely agree with the last part. Again, when you go back to just the facts of, you had a commercial department of 6,
yeah,
and now you've got a commercial department of 70.
We might have had 10, but
I think it starts. I was told 6 to 8, and then it gradually expanded.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, I've dealt with Arsenal on a commercial basis, and it's like dealing with any other corporate entity. They seem to have a attitude or an answer of no as a default position, whereas one thing I heard about yourself was your opening remark would be yes, now what's the question?
I think it's a risky thing to say depending on what the question is.
Yeah, but it was kind of, I heard it was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but it was a reflection of the attitude of can do. And if you look back at the club, let's go back all the way to the 1930s, you've got Herbert Chapman. You know, he was visionary. You know, he put the shirt numbers on. He got us to be the first team to play under floodlights. He got Gillespie Road changed to Arsenal. These were all progressive acts.
You know, we were the first people to use grow lights on the pitch, which is why the pitch is so great. And we were the first people to ever do that. We bought, you know, 8 rigs over to try it out, and it works. We put them in there. We bought them all for Hyper, and then moved them all to Emirates. So, you know, that kind of stuff, you're looking to do, how can you make everything better, and how can you move it all on and increase the experience for everybody? But I think behind it all is the most important principle, that you're a club and you've got fans, and I call them customers only because I want to treat them as customers, but people who have got, you know, this is a big part of their lives, and you've got to remember that when you're in the privileged position of running a club.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us today. I want to ask one more question.
One more. One more.
I like learning. What can I say? But during your time at the club, out of everything that you did, whether it was, you know, speaking to fans or, you know, watching the games or, you know, helping the move to the Emirates, what is your favourite moment or your favourite memory throughout your time there?
Well, the favourite time must be going on the open top bus when we won the double. I mean, you know, that was probably the most magical time.
Brilliant.
And seeing 500,000 fans, you know, on the streets and on the open top bus. Which was very, very fortunate and very, very lucky to be part of. So the good times were really great, you know, absolutely fantastic.
Well, I think you were there pretty much at the best times.
Yeah, yeah. Well, hopefully there's some relationship there.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You'd hope so, yeah.
Yeah. Well,
anyway.
Well, if there is, we want you back.
Yeah. Yeah, well, anyway. First of all, Julian, thanks for joining me. Hope you learned a lot today.
I did.
Good. As did I. Thank you very much, Keith, for joining us. Really do appreciate it. We have learned a lot today. And thank you, everyone, for listening. If you're listening on the, you know, audio platforms. And thank you very much for watching. If you're watching on AFTV VIP, we really do appreciate it. This is the second episode of the Marble Halls podcast, where we dive into the ins and outs of Arsenal Football Club. Hear it from Julian, the fan that's been there for a while of it, and hear from people like Sky Andrew last week and Keith, last episode, and Keith this week, and their roles that they've had in Arsenal's history. I'm learning a lot, and I'm going to keep learning. So, thank you all for listening. Tune in next time, and let's see who we've got next.